Barnes and Others versus Berry. Matthew A. Fitzgerald, Travis C. Gunn, Elizabeth S. Vaughn, Margaret R. Vaughn, A. Isabel Kaldenbach, Montemayor, Appellant's Counsel, Colleen M. Quinn, Mary G. McLaurin, Appellee's Counsel.
All right, case is Barnes and Others versus Berry. Appellant's Counsel may proceed.
May it please the court, Matt Fitzgerald on behalf of all of the appellants. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
The core issue in this case is the proper interpretation of Section 1250 of Virginia's adoption statutes. The Court of Appeals' error in misinterpreting Section 1250 injects needless uncertainty into newborn adoptions in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Subsection 1250F, at least apart from the deadline, unquestionably the section that applies here. Under that provision, Section 1250F, the law requires a reasonably ascertainable putative father, like Mr. Berry, be sent written notice of potential adoption. It then gives him 10 days from personal service or 13 days from a certified mailing to respond by registering a birth father. Importantly, subsection F specifies that this notice can be sent or presented by personal service before the child is ever born. Now, in this case, there's no question that Mr. Berry is a reasonably ascertainable putative father. There's no question that the notice was sent to him by certified mail, as the statute requires. And there's no question that he registered 44 days later, more than a month too late, under the time specified by subsection F.
The court counsel, excuse me, this is Justice Chaffin. When you refer to, there are two specific issues in that code section. If you look at 62.2 1250E, it provides that it is timely if the birth father registers within 10 days of the birth of the child. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It says within 10 days of the child's birth or to the time specified in subsection C or F. And our argument is that what that means in context is that if the deadline specified in C or F applies at all, then it governs. So it's a distributive form of the word or in this particular case, as used in this statute. It does not allow there to be two bites at the apple or multiple bites at the apple for any particular putative father, but it addresses the three different categories of fathers separately. So 10 days from the birth applies to putative fathers who are not reasonably ascertainable or who cannot be found. And that makes sense because there isn't any better way to give them notice. The child's birth is the trigger under those circumstances. But I think everybody would concede that if subsection C applies, that's the father who has been lied to about whether the child is alive, then that deadline is 10 days from discovering the truth, not either of the other two. And what we're saying is, in parallel to that, if the deadline in subsection F applies, then it also controls. And just as a pure textualist matter, this makes perfect sense under the text of subsection F, because it specifically states that the notice can be sent before the child is ever born. And so that really carries no meaning if it is true that there's actually never any such thing as a deadline until the child is at least 10 days old.
But counsel, it also states that the notice can be sent after the birth of the child, which would align with the 10 days under Romanet 1 of E. So what is your argument there? Does that have any application? Does it have any meaning here?
Sure, Your Honor. So if the notice were sent after the child was born, so let's say the notice is sent when the child is 3 or 4 days old, the father gets 13 days from the sending of that notice. So in that case, it would be until the child was 16 or 17 days old. Our argument is a categorical one that if the deadline in subsection F applies, then it controls whether that be before or after the child. But the
statute... your argument seemed to be that E had to apply to specific categories of fathers because the rationale or the meaning of this statute is to give as much notice to the father as possible while protecting the adoption. That sort of loses its punch if F also allows the notice to be given after the birth of the child.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. The key is the statute statement that it can be sent before the birth of the child, because I think everyone would recognize the system works the best when there is clarity and certainty from a putative father like this as early as possible. And you can see it in the other statutes that talk about the father denying paternity or the father granting his consent. All of those are explicit that can happen before the child is ever born. And so the parallel for that is here, where it says, essentially what it means is, if the birth mother and the adoption agency and the adoptive parents and everybody has all of their act together before the child is born, which is the norm, they can send this letter and they can gain certainty from the otherwise question mark of the putative birth father before the child is ever born. And that's perfectly reasonable. After all, everyone else in this scenario has all of their plans all together before the child is ever born. And it's entirely reasonable for the law to expect a putative father to come forward in at least one of the ways. I mean, after all, when we're talking about the birth father registry, we're talking about the very last ditch thing. There are multiple paths that a putative father can take to assert paternal right, starting with reconciling with and marrying the mother by the time the child is born. That's not everybody's thing, but you could also jointly swear to paternity with the mother under certain conditions. That perfects your rights. Failing that, you can file a petition to adjudicate paternity, which is a sworn pleading, taking on the responsibilities of fatherhood. None of those things happen here. And so what we're talking about is this very last-ditch thing. And what you see is short deadline. Each of the three types of putative fathers, the unknown ones, the known ones, and the ones who have been lied to. There are parallel 10 to 13 day deadlines for each of them. And that is the way that the statute is set up. Specifically,
Counsel, I don't disagree with you that those of you who worked on this statute probably intended for the statute to be set up that way. But first of all, how do we read E, the 10-day limit, to apply to the unknown putative fathers whose whereabouts are not known? Where do we glean that language to only apply, or that person to only be captured in the 10-day?
Yes, Your Honor, that is essentially the catch-all. So what it's really saying is, in this structure, it's within 10 days of the child's birth or the time specified in CRF. And so if CRF apply at all, which is to these specific categories, then that's the deadline. So it's used in the same way as this. Let's imagine there were a statute that said something like, all briefs are due in 30 days or the time specified by the particular court. If this court made a rule that said briefs here are due in 25 days, nobody would come along and say in this court, well, my brief is actually not due until the 30th day because I'm entitled to this disjunctive or. It says either or, and I choose the long one. But that's the argument that Mr. Berry is making here. That's the same kind of parallel use. Additionally, it really doesn't make sense for the adoption structure to be set up to allow reasonably ascertainable putative fathers who are the easiest to get a hold of, the easiest to gain clarity from, for them to have, in all cases, 10 days after the child's birth, even if they've been sent this certified mail notice weeks or months before the child is born. If that's true, what that effectively means is that in ordinary cases, fathers will always have at least 10, and in many cases, 30 days or more after the child is born, before they will ever have to say whether they object at all. That is far beyond the times that are set and ordinarily used for the birth mother. Again, everyone else has planned for this ahead of the child's birth and has proceeded accordingly. The birth father's failure to satisfy the timeline puts him on the outside. Now, there's a second issue in the case, which is whether the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court should have dismissed this petition even though no one asked it to do that. And the answer is no. Everything that the mother did, birth mother did, was to preserve the status quo pending the father's appeal. She revoked her consent in that moment. She did not ask for custody of the child back, and the custody of the child has been with the adoptive parents ever since. Had in the trial court, either the other side or either of the judges ever said, well, what are we doing here? I don't have either consent. Shouldn't this petition be dismissed? She would have renewed her consent or told them what was going on, and this all could have been ironed out. The fact is, both of the trial courts have been holding this case since the fall of 2019 to await the appellate court's ruling on the first issue, and that's exactly what they should have done. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
3 minutes and 49 seconds. Ms. Quinn, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Colleen Quinn, counsel for John Berry, the birth father in this case. Your Honors, this is a compelling case of a dad who wanted to parent, made it very clear that he wanted to parent, being given the procedural runaround and thus denied his constitutional right to parent his child. And he now has been deprived of parenting his child for nearly a year and a half. Your Honors, I believe that when this statute, the Birth Father Registry, which previously was the Putative Father Registry, was originally enacted, that in all likelihood, it was intended for a birth father not to have two bites at the apple. However, that's not how the statute got written. The statute got written with the word or, and statutes are written for lay people to understand, and they need to be written clearly for lay people to understand. And when we look at the whole line of cases where this court and the Court of Appeals has interpreted the word or, when it has been in a statute, it is clear that it means either one or the other. And in this statute, when we look at 63.212.50E, it does not say that registration is timely if it's received by the department within 10 days of the child's birth, only for unknown dads. That's not what it says. It says within 10 days of the child's birth or the time specified in C or F. And then it says registration is complete when the signed registration form is first received by the department. And it doesn't say when it's first received by the department by this type of dad versus that type of dad, the known dad versus the unknown dad. That's not what the statute says. When we look at the entire line of cases on or, in a statutory context, it is one or the other. Appellant wants
Counsel,
to cite
this is
cases Jeff, from
it's Chelsea. May I interrupt you with a question? I'm tracking what you're saying, and I get the textualist point, and particularly as Judge Petty very well described it in the opinion for the Court of Appeals. What do we do with the fact that we have cases, including one 3 years ago, the Atlantic Pipeline case, that says, well, and can mean or can mean and it all depends on context. And then we have another recent case, neither of which I joined in, by the way, that said, you know what, the paramount principle above all principles is what we think they intended as opposed to what they actually wrote. So your case, like many cases, stress out those two paradigms. How do you fit into that great debate?
So, Your Honors, when we're talking about statutory construction, when it involves constitutional rights. This court said in Copeland versus Todd that these adoption cases invoke significant substantive and procedural safeguards to protect the biological parents' due process rights. So we need to interpret this statute liberally in favor of my client. Moreover, Your Honor, the Sozio versus Thorpe case cited, this court cited, the Court of Appeals, excuse me, cited Carter versus Nelms. The question here is not what the legislature intended to enact, but what is the meaning of that which it did enact? We must determine the legislative intent by what the statute says and not by what we think it should have said. And if we read the statute, you cannot read it harmoniously to say that the known father only gets this time and the unknown father only gets that time, because we have this other provision in the statute, 63.2.1250D, that says a man will not prejudice his rights by failing to register if he files a petition for genetic testing or files a petition, commences a proceeding to adjudicate his paternity before the petition to accept or waive adoption consent is filed. And in this case, Mr. Berry did file a petition for genetic testing. In fact, he filed it before the child was born. And so if we read the statute harmoniously, we can't ignore that section that says he doesn't have to register at all. The guy can get the mailing, he can get the personal service, but if he fails to register, he can still file a petition for genetic testing. So I think we have to read or, not as and, but as or, and as it was stated in the cases that we cited in our brief, that or needs to be you get one or you get the other or you get both. Because we have this other provision, if we try to read this whole thing harmoniously, that says he doesn't have to register at all. He can just go ahead and file this petition for genetic testing, which in this case he did. The other thing that we can't ignore, Justice Kelsey, is the fact that sending something by certified mail has its fallacies. 25 years ago, the U.S. Postal Service did a much better job, and people looked at certified mail as a much more reliable way of getting things. Whenever I send any certified mailing to a birth father in any adoption, I always use Federal Express with proof of delivery as backup because of the fallacies of certified mailing. Certified mail, it involves sometimes going to the post office and picking up the little card. Things get lost in the mail. In this case, it got put into the wrong mailbox. And so that also weighs in favor of us in a case involving a parent's right to parent, a constitutional right. It means this court needs to interpret this statute liberally in favor of my client, especially given the looseness of certified mailing. The other difficulty in this case is that Catholic Charities had my client in front of them, knowing they had sent him something by certified mail, and didn't even bother to say, can we confirm your address? And by the way, we're going to be sending you this little notice in the mail, and it's kind of important, and you need to go ahead and register. And so to compound the issues in this case, there was my client being completely misled by Catholic Charities. This client is not like the client in Lair versus Robinson. This client, John Berry, wanted to parent. He went to the doctor visits. He went to two different adoption agencies. He made it very clear that he objected to the adoption. He wanted to parent. He read parenting books. He got a nursery ready. He filed with the putative father registry when he got actual notice of the certified mail, when the postal worker was downstairs at the mailbox and said, hey, you've got this other mailbox is filled with mail. Did you realize this other mailbox was down here too in this apartment complex? And by the way, here's the certified mailing. Now, I understand in the record that there is a certified mail purportedly signed by my client, but that's not his signature. And he said he never got that. And so when we look at how certified mail works, this statute needs to be fixed. When I was in front of Judge Yaffe in Henrico County a number of years ago, and Judge Yaffe interpreted the statute the way it needs to be interpreted because of the word or, I turned to Barbara Jones, who co-wrote the adoption book with me, and I said, this statute needs to be fixed. It's not written in a harmonious way that makes a lot of sense. And we need to go back to the drawing board, and we need to make it clear that just like the Court of Appeals held, that if the legislature intended that you only got one or the other, then the legislature could have worded the statute very clearly and said that if that you don't get both, that if you are in C or F, you don't also get up until 10 days after the birth to register. We also need to read it in conjunction with the Equal Protection Clause. A woman gets to wait until 3 days after birth, and then she gets another 7 days to revoke. Why is it that a man gets notice, can get notice when the birth mother is only 2 months pregnant, and now he only has 10 or 13 days to respond, and yet she has a much longer period to make her mind up with regard to whether she wants to go through with her adoption plan? And so when
Ms.
we look Quinn, at an argument, yes, Ms. Ma'am.
Quinn,
yes,
there seem to be two differing opinions as to what should have happened to this case once the birth mother withdrew her consent. Would you turn your attention to that and help me with the interpretation of 1234 and 1233 with regard to what should have happened to the case once the birth mother withdrew her consent?
Yes, Justice Powell, and I'm glad you asked me that, because that is the second reason why my client does have standing in this case as well. When the birth mother revoked her consent, we have to look at the two code sections that you've just cited. First of all, we look at 63.2.1234, when consent is revocable, and we look at 1B, upon the filing of a valid revocation within the time period set out in this section, the Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court shall order any consent given for the purpose of such placement is void, which the court did do in this case. And if necessary, the Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court shall determine custody of the child as between the birth parents. What happened when her consent was revoked was there was no longer a consent pending before the court. And then we need to look over at 63.2.1233.3, which basically says that except for subdivisions 4 and 5, if consent cannot be obtained from at least one birth parent, the JDR court shall deny the petition, and determine custody of the child pursuant to the code section with regard to a child that might be abandoned, neglect, or whose custody is that is in question, and that's 16.2-278.2.
But is so this a situation where consent could not be obtained? Is that the meaning of 1233? I have two parents, either of whom are capable of giving consent. Would 1233 really look to a situation where either the parents are not known, or, well, certainly the mother would be known, but not available to give consent, or perhaps both are deceased? Does this envision two parents who are available who could give consent?
No, Your Honor, I believe it envisions where you have a situation where neither parent's consenting, or maybe you have a deceased parent and you have the other one that's not consenting. So in order for the adoption to proceed, you have to have the consent of at least one parent. And so in this case, you did not have the consent of at least one parent. You had a parent that initially was consenting that then changed her mind and she revoked. And therefore, there was no consenting party, and therefore there was no ability to keep that petition going forward. And there was no need for anybody to file anything to dismiss the petition, because the statute says shall. It says the court shall dismiss the petition and determine custody of the child. So
is there a wrinkle? Is there a wrinkle, counsel, where neither of these code sections fit nicely because the case was on appeal?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, because the juvenile court still had jurisdiction over the matter when the birth mother revoked. She still had jurisdiction and she still had the ability to dismiss the petition at that point. Moreover, on appeal with the circuit court stepped into the shoes of the juvenile court. And so when the circuit court got the case and saw that the birth mother had revoked, then the circuit court had the duty to dismiss the petition. One or the other had the duty to dismiss the petition because the statute says shall, and there was no pending active consent before either court. And shall means shall. It doesn't need somebody to file an action that says, could you please dismiss the petition? It orders the court what to do in that case. You can't have an adoption go forward unless you have at least one consenting party. And in this case, we had none. When she revoked her consent, my client then had the genetic testing petition in front of the court that the court should have gone ahead and ruled that my client have the genetic or paternity testing done to confirm that he was in fact the father, and then determine custody as between the birth parents pursuant to the two statutes. That did not happen in this case. In fact, my client was kept in the dark that the birth mom had even revoked, because the juvenile court and the circuit court refused to unseal the file. So he had no way of even knowing that she had revoked and pushing the agenda forward in that regard and pointing out to the court, hey, you don't have a consent in front of you. You need to dismiss this petition and you need to consider my petition for genetic testing. The other thing, Your Honor, Justice Powell, there was gamesmanship played in this case, including a pre-birth filing by the adoptive parents to try to circumvent, because the attorneys knew that my client still had the ability to file a petition for genetic testing, even if he hadn't registered timely under that 13-day rule, that he could file that petition. And instead, they filed a pre-birth adoption petition before there was even a child in existence, which I contend was void or should have been vacated. They shouldn't have been allowed to have filed a pre-birth. Otherwise, in these cases, attorneys for adoptive parents could file adoption petitions when the birth mom's just 1 or 2 months pregnant. And so when we go back and we have to read the statute harmoniously, we have to read or as in my client got until 10 days after birth, because you do get more than one bite at the apple, especially if you're able to file for genetic testing, especially if you're able to file genetic testing without somebody trying to preempt you doing it by filing a pre-birth petition for adoption, which was attempted in this case. Your Honors, I do want to point out that the or cases cited by the appellant are either from out of state or they involve cases from the 1800s and early 1900s that involve the interpretation of wills and other documents. So in those cases, they're not involving the Virginia cases are not involving the interpretation of the word or in a statute. And as cited in our brief, have a long line of cases interpreting the word or as you get one or the other. And if this court were to rule otherwise, then you've just vacated or you've negated a whole line or overturned a whole line of criminal cases in particular, as well as the other cases that we've cited in our brief with regard to the interpretation of the word or. And so for this court to be consistent with its prior court rulings, it has to read the statute as giving my client up until 10 days after the birth. And he registered way before the birth. He also filed his paternity or genetic testing action. He tried to do everything he could to protect his rights as a parent, and he's now been deprived for a year and a half of being able to parent his child. When we look at Copeland versus Todd, and we look at the constitutionality of a person's parental rights and the right to parent, this court's got to uphold the Court of Appeals. And again, Your Honors, I would stress that the question here is not what the legislator might have intended or what the attorneys that put this statute into place, including myself, might have intended. It's what got put into the statute. A lot of changes were happening as the statute went through. Delegate Kilgore, Delegate Bell, they were really concerned about the notice provision. Delegate Kilgore even said during the proceedings, he said, you mean to tell me that if my son is dating some girl that he's got to put a little postcardy thing in the mail in order to protect his rights when she knows darn well that he's the dad and that she's pregnant, et cetera. And so there was a lot of concern during the enactment of this statute about making sure that a birth father's rights were duly protected. And I believe it's incumbent upon this court to uphold the Court of Appeals and protect my client so that he can go and fight for his son and finally be able to parent, as he indicated from early on. He told two different adoption agencies, I want to parent my child. I'm capable of parenting. He would make an outstanding parent, and he's been deprived of that. Right. Without any further questions, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Clemens.
Your time has expired.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think we understand your case.
Mr. Thank you Fitzgerald? Very much, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, just a few points. So this is a case where the parties agree what the General Assembly meant in this statute. Opposing counsel has said and basically essentially testified as to what the General Assembly meant, and we all agree it meant exactly what we are arguing that it means. Now, in terms of the plain text, I say these things are not in conflict with each other. It's a perfectly ordinary use of the term or for it to be distributive in this sense. You can see it discussed at length in the recent U.S. Supreme Court case Encino Motor Cars, where the court mentioned that Chief Justice Marshall had used the distributive or. There are 200 years of cases from this court acknowledging that or is subject to its context and can vary in meaning somewhat based on the context, and that's exactly the situation here.
Mr. Fitzgerald, would you address the question that I had of Ms. Quinn? Which of the code sections, 1234.1b or 1233.3, govern what the juvenile court should have done in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, it's 1234. It's the section that's relevant to a parent revoking consent. It says it shall adjudicate custody between the birth parents if necessary, and it simply wasn't necessary in this case. There is an order entered by the JDR court at Joint Appendix page 10, granting legal custody to the Scanlons. The mother revoked her consent, but she never asked for any change to be made to that order, and it wasn't. So there is something left of that proceeding, which is the order granting legal custody to the adoptive parents. All that the mother wanted to, the provision about the revoking consent is far more on point than the one about no consent can be obtained. The 1233, where it talks about no consent can be obtained, then it says we'll adjudicate custody under the statutory provision that deals with abandoned and neglected children. That is exactly not the situation here. And I acknowledge this is a gray area, but I want to emphasize all the mother wanted to do was preserve the status quo pending the appeal. She did not want to make her consent final and irrevocable, potentially losing all of her parental rights before anyone could know whether the father would have any. And had either of the judges or the other side, and by the way, the birth father is named as a party on the actual order voiding the consent after she revoked it, which is the same way that all the other parties were served with this order. That's in the joint appendix, page 4. So if anyone had ever said, we have a problem about this, it would have been fixed back then. Those courts have waited for the outcome, and that's what they should have done. Now, so additionally, there's argument that certified mail isn't reliable. The fact is the General Assembly selected certified mail, and they did that in 2009. A signed postal receipt, which is in the record at JA-119, came back to the adoption agency here. So all of the parties on our side had a signed receipt with his name on it that says he got it 2 days after we sent it. When they didn't get any response, no registry, they moved forward with their adoption plans. There was absolutely not gamesmanship. This petition was filed just a couple of days before the baby was born, several days after he was due to be born. It was done in order to get a more soon date in the JDR court for the taking of the mother's consent. It takes some time to get a court date, and so the filings have to be done a little bit early. The father had essentially blew his deadline. There is no constitutional right that comes into play here. This court has said specifically there's no constitutional right based on biology alone. The fathers have to follow these statutes. And the petition for genetic testing that he filed fails on three grounds. It was first held not to qualify as a petition to adjudicate parentage by the trial court at JA 534. Mr. Berry then did not appeal that, and the Court of Appeals recognized that at 733 of the Joint Appendix, footnote 4. Additionally, it was later than the petition to accept consent, so it wasn't timely. And on its merit, it was inadequate. The statute requires...
Justice Powell, has he answered your question?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, he has. Thank you.
All right, your time has expired as well. The court will take a recess until 5 minutes to 11.